Hello. Welcome to Focus on Community. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and we are live on the air tonight on this beautiful, crisp winter evening for this month's edition of a radio program dedicated to informing Southeast Alaska K2 listeners about a myriad of psychological and social issues confronting us in our daily lives, and ultimately about living our lives with more awareness and greater happiness. Just what is mental illness? Where is the line in our culture between being what is called mentally ill and just being different or eccentric? Is mental illness determined by genetics, by environment, or by some other cause? Or is it a combination of factors? Or is it still a mystery? Is mental illness treatable? Is there always a definitive diagnosis? And how are mentally ill people viewed in this society? What are the stereotypes of mental illness? And what kinds of discrimination do people with mental illness face? Tonight, with my guests from the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Juneau, we will take a long, deep look at the phenomena we call mental illness and how it affects family members. According to the NAMI newsletter, and NAMI stands for National Alliance on Mental Illness, approximately 2,000 Juneauites are coping with serious depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other debilitating conditions. And as I said, our show is live from the K2 studios. And we encourage you to call in to 463-6455. That's 463-6455. So don't be shy. Contact us anytime during the show, and either I or my guests will respond to your question or comment. But first, let me welcome our two guests from the Juneau office of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Welcome, Katie Chapman and Michelle Thompson.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome. And Katie, you're familiar with the K2 setup here, because I think you have your own program.
I am familiar. I volunteer for KRNN Cross Currents Tuesday mornings from 8 to 10.
Great. Have you ever been in the K2 building before, Michelle?
No, this is my first time.
Okay, well, super. Welcome. Katie is the Executive Director at NAMI, N-A-M-I, National Alliance for on Mental Illness. And so tell us what you do at the NAMI office.
Well, at NAMI Juneau, we have programs to support our mission, which is to provide support, education, and advocacy to those whose lives are impacted by mental illness. So I oversee some programs and support groups that we have in the community and work with other community agencies.
Okay. And you didn't just move to Juneau, so what were you doing beforehand?
I recently graduated with my master's in social work.
Great.
From the University of Alaska Anchorage. And for the last, 4.5 years, I worked for the Office of Children's Services as a field worker. Trauma. And
yeah.
Prior to that, I was a case manager for Juneau Youth Services.
Great. So you've lived here how many years?
For almost 13.
Oh, good. Good. And Michelle, I understand that you're a teacher at Floyd Dryden Middle School, right?
That is correct.
So what is your involvement in NAMI?
Well, my first notice of NAMI was an email that was sent by a colleague that had gone through the family-to-family class, and that was about three and a half years ago. And I thought that was interesting, a group of people that get together to learn about mental illness, because I'm a special education teacher and I also have family members that have mental illness. So that was my first experience with NAMI.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to take the family to family class.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a real eye-opener for me.
So you have a family member, and you said it was your parents. Okay.
That is correct. My father is bipolar. He had incidents of manic mm-hmm. and depressive incidents when okay. we were growing up, but he wasn't diagnosed until about 3 years ago.
Okay.
There were times where he would be working two or three jobs, and we didn't realize that it was manic at the time. And my mother was a depressed person, I guess. But when you grow up in a household where your mother is depressed and your father is never home, you don't realize that that's mental illness. You just realize that that's how life is. So taking the family-to-family class helped me to not only gain a community, but realize that what you don't know, you don't know.
And is there some harm in not knowing?
Yes, I think that there is a lot of harm. There's a lot of guilt. There's a lot of blame that you have mm-hmm. towards the people who are mentally ill if you don't understand that they're not in control of what's going on any more than you're in control of what they're doing.
Well, I did a radio show about 2 years ago on resiliency and kids growing up in very troubled families who turned out really well, who were resilient. And one of the studies actually was done in Hawaii of the offspring of schizophrenic mothers. And it was found that there was a positive correlation that the kids were very likely to turn out pretty well as long as they had a mentor who somewhat served as an alternative parent. So it could be a coach or a teacher. Hey, it's wonderful you're a teacher. Yeah. And or a grandmother or somebody else who gave them a view of normalcy. And what I found clinically, I agree with you completely, I think it's much better to know what's going on and to actually have a label for it than to think it's normal. Because if we grow up thinking that it's not about aberrant, it's about harmful behaviors are normal, or behaviors that cause suffering are normal, then how do we know how to live healthier, happier lives?
Yes, and I was very fortunate, and so was my sister and my brother, to be able to spend time with our grandparents, to be able to go over to their house and just be kids and not have to worry about taking care of someone else or have to, make our own food, or, we could just be kids. We could go out in the backyard and come back in and have fun.
Well, I'll never forget when I was a therapist in Seattle, I worked with a woman who was actually doing quite well as an adult, but she grew up with a very mentally ill mother. And the story she told me just really, really, very poignant. She said that her mother was delusional and her father worked all the time, which may not be a coincidence. So her mother was delusional. They lived way out in the country. And everybody sort of pretended it was normal. So when she was growing up with this delusional mother, she started reading books on mental health and realized that her mother was paranoid and delusional and had a mental illness. But nobody would call it. The mother never got any help. And then she said she was 18. When she was 18, her father was gone, they're out of the house, and her mother had a severe breakdown and became pretty violent. And the daughter packed her in the car, brought her to the nearest large city, and went to the state mental health hospital and brought her mother in. And she said she was sitting in the waiting room, now remember she's 18, for a couple of hours. And finally, the doctor came out, and imagine this is like 30 years ago, 30 or 40 years ago, and had examined her mother and said, "I have very bad news for you." And then they gave the daughter the diagnosis, which was pretty serious. And the daughter said it was her liberating moment, that her mother was going to be taken care of And she knew then that what was going on at home was not normal and that she was going to be okay. So just that that diagnosis,
yeah,
she said,
and
made
the
all
fact
the difference.
That and the fact that there is a name for it.
There's
that,
a name for it.
And that there are other people that are experiencing what you're experiencing, that
mm-hmm.
there's, like I mentioned earlier, that there's a community. As a child with parents who are mentally ill, my sister and my brother were my community, and I didn't realize that. And, you know, we fought. We had scuffles as kids, and, you know, they resented me for being the big sister and telling them what to do. And now that they're, you know, we're all grown up, it's, you know, we have this common experience that has bonded us probably beyond what normal siblings might have.
Yeah.
Because we've experienced something that is abnormal.
Yeah. And you survive together.
Yeah.
Yeah. My clients, some of whom have grown up with mentally ill parents or alcoholic parents, have said they lost out on their childhood. They had to be the rational, sane person. You were the oldest sister. Did you take care of your siblings?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Did you ever seek out therapy?
I did. I was fortunate enough to seek not only my grandparents as you know, caregivers, but also I became quite involved in my church, in the youth group mm-hmm. in Portland, and I was able to connect with the youth minister and the pastor of the church that I went to, and I think that they saw that I was struggling, and that mm-hmm. and they influenced me in a way that, you know, it wasn't pressure to seek counseling, but they said, hey, if you wanted to talk to somebody, these people are available. And so I kind of got into counseling without realizing what it was. And it wasn't that I was tricked. It was that, oh, wait, I can sit here and talk all about me for an hour. I don't have to talk about anybody else or solve anybody's problem.
Oh.
I can just talk. And that was pretty much right after I'd graduated from high school, you know, that year after you graduate from high school where you're questioning, you're not sure what you want to do. So I was able to do that. And my dad, this was before his breakdown, he said, Michelle, you just got angry. And we didn't realize that you were so angry, because I'm a very quiet person. I'm not somebody who lashes out. I've never been in a fist fight. I've
mm-hmm.
nothing like that. But they... My dad was very prolific, I guess, in saying, you were angry. And it's like, yeah, I was. And I told him why I was angry, and he said, oh, okay.
Ah, okay. So do you think the counseling you had helped you?
I believe it did. It helped me to just accept that I can't control someone else. That my mother's behavior when I was a child was out of my control. It wasn't something that if I would have, you know, put the dishes away on time, or if I would have, you know,
yeah.
got my brother to school 2 minutes earlier, you know.
Yeah.
She was the way she was, and she is the way she is, and I just have to accept her and love her for who she is.
Yeah, yeah. You didn't cause it, and you're not going to cure it.
Exactly.
Right. Which
the
is
four
a,
C's.
Yeah. Yes.
By David Karp.
Oh, really? Okay, I didn't know where that came from. I knew I didn't make
yeah.
it up.
Yeah, from his book, The Burden of Sympathy. I just read it. The four C's are you didn't cause it, you can't control it, there's no cure for it. All you can do is learn how to cope with it.
Oh, that's even a wonderful addition.
Yes.
To my two C's. Yeah. Now, Michelle, you lead some of the family-to-family groups. Would you call yourself an instructor? Because they're educational groups, aren't they?
Yeah, I went through the training last spring, and
uh-huh.
I co-taught the class for most of the sessions this last fall.
How many people were in the last class?
Well, we started out with about 12.
Right.
Yeah, we started out with about 12, and we ended up with about 3.
Yes.
It's a 12-week course, and it can get pretty intense for individuals who have family members that are, the family members are in crisis.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to be able to take the class living in Alaska, And my family does not live in Alaska. My family does not live in Juneau. For individuals that have to deal with family members, like I said, in crisis.
On the spot.
On the spot.
In the house.
Day to day.
Right.
It can get, it's overwhelming. And to be able to deal with your emotions at the same time. So some of the people who started the class ended up just either dropping out or going to a support group because that's what they needed at the time. They didn't need to learn about bipolar if their family member had schizophrenia, and they didn't need to learn about PTSD if their family member was bipolar.
So the group is not, I mean, the family-to-family is primarily educational, but what I find, I lead the bereavement group for hospice, and though there's some education there, you can't help have it be supportive in the sense that you're at least with other people who are in the same predicament in general with a mentally ill family member.
That is correct, yes.
But I did notice there is the NAMI basics course. Is that the same thing?
No.
No. Okay. No. Basics education program. And then it goes, what does it include? So that's just a different format,
yeah,
probably.
Yeah, the NAMI basics. You're looking at the list of programs for NAMI. Yeah.
Okay. And you said some of them will end up going to a support group. Tell me about the support group.
Well, I'm going to let Katie speak on the support group
because
I've attended one support group, and that was about 2 years ago.
Okay. Katie, tell me about the support group.
The support groups are for family members and caregivers or friends of people with a mental illness. It's a peer support group. Family members come there to share their experience, their coping skills, and different strategies to problem solve. But it's basically a time and a space for caregivers, family members, and friends to come and connect, and those are held every Thursday night from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. at the Family Birth Center.
And can should they contact you first?
Nope.
They can just show up?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just there's no registration, there's no cost. It's a time and a place that's free and available for folks just to come in and get a little extra support. And like Michelle mentioned, you know, having that community. You know, that peer support.
Oh, yeah. And how many people usually show up for the support group?
Lately, it's been about 5 or 6 people.
Okay. Nice size.
Yeah.
And do you lead it?
Yes. I facilitate it.
You facilitate it.
Yes.
Right. Okay. There's another program that I believe NAMI Juneau does, and that's Breaking the Silence curriculum?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Very exciting.
Okay.
Breaking the Silence is a NAMI curriculum that is geared toward stigma busting mental illness. It's taught with youth. There's curriculum for elementary, middle school, and high schoolers. Mm-hmm. And Juneau last year started to go into the high schools and continue to do so. Our hope is to start working more with middle schoolers. But the curriculum, we go into the health classes and give a general overview about what mental illness is and then talk about some of the stereotypes mm-hmm. and stigma busting. So
How many sessions? How many classes? Hour long classes?
They're taught in the health classes. So I've been try to see the classes like 2 days in a row, each class. And
okay. Yeah. And how long have you been doing this?
NAMI started doing this last year.
Are you personally going in?
Oh, I am personally going
You're
in.
You're it.
Yes.
You're the teacher. Excellent.
And
She'd be great.
Yeah.
Katie would be great. She almost looks, and this is a compliment. If, you know, she could be a senior in
Whoa.
High school. She is so cute and youthful looking.
Hey.
Oh, well. She'd fit in. She'd be great.
It's really fun. I was really surprised at, well, it's been a little while for as young as I look. It's been a little while since I've been.
Well, there's a few wrinkles.
It's been a while since I've been in high school, and I couldn't remember really, you know, what I learned about mental illness when I was in high school. And I was surprised when I was at the school. The youth are so hungry for the information about mental illness, and they don't know very much about it.
Katie, what would you say? You know, when I introduced the program, I said, where is the line in our culture between being what is called mentally ill and just being different or eccentric? That'd be the kind of thing a high school student might ask you.
Oh.
What would you say?
In different words.
Yeah, in different words.
Well, weird.
Is he weird or is he mentally ill?
Right.
I mean, you know, he doesn't have any friends. He doesn't look me in the eye.
Yeah. Or mentally ill wouldn't be the words that youth
crazy.
Use. Crazy, psycho, schizo.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, in part of what I presented to the youth were, you know, signs of depression, for example, and just letting them know that certainly it's okay to feel sad if somebody dies or if your girlfriend breaks up with you or your boyfriend breaks up with you. It's okay to feel sad. However, like if you start to feel hopeless and worthless and this persists over, you know, more than 2 weeks, like, then that's not normal, and you know, there could be something more going on, and it would probably be good to go see a doctor or a counselor or to talk to some adult about it. So just, I guess, where that fine line is, I think definitely validating to them that feeling anxious is okay, too, sometimes. Do you think?
Yes and no. I wouldn't let you off the hook there if I were a kid.
What?
I'd say, but I'm not a kid, so you know I'm just doing this. Wait a second. Are you saying that somebody whose sadness goes on too long is mentally ill? See, what's the difference between... See, the word mentally ill already has a deeper meaning. Depending on who you are, it doesn't necessarily have a stigma attached, but it has a profound meaning. Usually, I think in the average person would think somebody who is mentally ill could not lead as an adult a normally functional life. I mean, I think that would be about how high functioning somebody was. So you could still say, what does it mean to be the difference between being depressed? Is somebody who's depressed mentally ill?
Are you asking me that?
Yeah.
No. I would say no.
What about if they're seriously depressed and they can't get out of bed? See,
yeah, I know.
Yeah, there's
it's
no
hard.
Line, is there?
Yeah.
There's no line.
Yeah.
Where would you draw the line?
Well, it would depend on the individual and the circumstances surrounding that individual in their life. You know, it's not a one.
You know, I think it's very culturally determined.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my opinion, having worked in the field for like 30 years. I think we all have different brains. And our Western psychiatric tradition definitely tries to put labels, and it is wonderful to have certain labels. It's not bad in and of themselves because you communicate with other mental health professionals. It gives you a cluster of symptoms that are similar from one to another. But more frequently, if I have the parents of an adult mentally ill child coming in, they can often, I'd say, spin their wheels looking for a diagnosis. For example, you said your dad wasn't diagnosed until, what, 3 years ago?
Yeah, about 4 years ago.
And sometimes I think people mistake the idea that you get a diagnosis and that'll tell you what to do to make the person better. The way it worked, I think, for you, that a diagnosis helped you realize that this wasn't normal behavior. Right, Michelle?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Especially for my father. We didn't know how he could sustain, you know, going to college, working a full-time job, working a part-time job, how he was never home, and growing up, my parents never had friends. And I didn't realize that that was abnormal until I became an adult. And I'm like, if I didn't have my friends, I don't know what I would do.
Why didn't your parents have friends?
That's a good question. I think that a friendship is two people or more, you know, in a relationship. And my parents weren't able to have a relationship, weren't able to have that give and take necessarily with another person. And if you don't have that give and take, then people pretty soon, you know, they either take or they go away. And I think that's what happened with my mom's friends first, and then it happened with my dad's friends.
Well, if he was all wrapped up in himself in a manic sort of lifestyle, he wouldn't have time for friends. And then if your mother was severely depressed, she would also be pretty wrapped up in herself and maybe socially isolated.
Yeah.
Yeah, so both conditions could lead to lack of friendship, you can see. And that's where you talk about levels of functioning.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'd even consider somebody. Well, I remember when it was the city treasurer, when I was in grad school in Seattle, I think the city treasurer, you ran for office, I think, to be city attorney or city treasurer, and he disclosed that he was bipolar, manic depressive, and he disclosed it in advance. And this was, I've been here 30 years, so this has to be a long, long time ago, okay, and in those days. It was an interesting preemptive move, because I think he was afraid that somebody would spill the beans about maybe he had a couple of hospitalizations. But I'm happy to say that he won the election.
Wow.
So whatever he did, it was a good strategy.
Yeah.
But that's very interesting, because I get clients coming in who are very concerned if I have to send things to their insurance company, like a diagnosis at the very least, because you have to in order for them to get their services paid for. They're afraid about they're concerned about the confidentiality of those records. And if they ever ran for public office or anything, it could harm them, which brings us into the notion of stigmatization.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, did you say, Katie, that in your class you dealt with the idea of stigma?
Yeah, right. And we talk about stigma, what stigma is, and give examples.
Okay. But what is, see, now this is interesting.
Yeah.
And this morning's newspaper.
Oh,
anybody read this morning's newspaper? And you could have an example of stigmatization. Well, not stigmatization, an example of something that was pretty scary. And a ranger at Mount Rainier was killed, Mount Rainier National Park, was killed by a man. The suspect, they went into detail, had body, they found his car, and he went on a killing rampage. Okay, including killing a ranger at Mount Rainier, and the suspect is suspected of other killings earlier in the day. They found his abandoned car with body armor and weapons, and then they said he's an Iraq veteran.
Oh,
click. PTSD. Click. Okay, so then. PTSD, and I noticed in your NAMI literature, you, am I pronouncing it right? Is it NAMI or NAMI?
Tomato, tomato.
Okay,
whichever
tomato, tomato. I'm from the South Side of Chicago, so I say NAMI. That's my accent. But in the NAMI literature, they talked about PTSD as one of the conditions that may have people, say, joining the family-to-family program if a family member has PTSD. Of course, the range of PTSD could be mild to severe, and severe, so the implication that I'm getting at is one of the fears that people would have about mental illness is that the person who's mentally ill is dangerous and violent.
Right, that is one of the myths. I mean, we talk about that in this Breaking the Silence, you know, how movies often portray that violence as well.
Mm-hmm.
And with the young man who shot at the congresswoman, I can never remember his name.
Right.
But, I mean, you see cases like that, and those are out in the media. And so then everyone assumes that all people with schizophrenia or all people who have schizophrenia or who have bipolar are violent and are going to shoot at others.
Right.
But you don't ever hear on the radio the TV about the person who has schizophrenia and is a successful mother, you know, is a good parent, is a...
Or a math genius.
A math genius, or, you know, finished college, or, you know, you don't ever hear those success stories. So.
Well, the other side of it is that there will be people... I mean, this is getting into the cultural definition of mental illness. Now, would somebody who goes on a killing rampage be mentally ill by definition? What do you think? What does... And I'm not looking at the DSM...
Okay.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I'm looking at people out there. And I'm just asking you each, as two people, not your professional opinion, just your gut reaction, would you consider somebody who went on a shooting rampage mentally ill, per se?
I don't think so. I mean, what if they're, you know...
What do you think?
Well, I think that you could assume either way, but I don't think that that's necessarily evident in their, just because their behavior is to kill people doesn't make them mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to say something. Trying to figure out what they're trying to say is probably the hardest part.
Yeah. And I think that would be a question that our listeners could puzzle over. What's the difference? You know, what's the difference between being homicidal? Is there a difference? Are all homicidal people mentally ill? And we certainly know the vast majority of people who have been diagnosed with the mental illness are not violent.
Right.
And that we know. And so it is just that conundrum. Yes, Katie?
Oh, however, I was going to say, in the cases where folks with mental illness have substance abuse issues, they do tend to be more violent.
Yeah. And that's called dual diagnosis.
Right. Yeah, co-occurring.
And?
So
a good example. And people I've worked with who have just substance abuse issues tend to be a lot angrier, because what happens is their executive part of their brain goes offline, and you're more likely to have poor judgment. So you get more angry, you engage in sexual misconduct when you have a substance, when you're addicted, when you're drunk, when you're stoned. So I just like to explain to our listeners that I am Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and in the studio with me are Katie Chapman, Executive Director of the Juno Office of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Michelle Thompson, a leader of the family-to-family group for people who have a mentally ill family member. And our show is live from the K2 studios, and we encourage you to call in at 463-6455, and we'll get you on the air without identifying you by name. So don't be shy. We'd love to hear your opinions or your ideas, or if you have any questions for me or for our guests. But our wonderful tech guy here, Jeff, who came in on his day off, said he had some appropriate music for us, and I wonder if he would play it.
Drop from
Welcome back. And I want to give due credit to Katie Chapman for choosing this song. I at first thought Jeff might have, but I want to give credit to Katie. And I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. And Katie Chapman, the Executive Director of the Juno Office of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, is with me, as well as Michelle Thompson, who's a leader of the family-to-family group for people whose family member has a mental illness. And our show is live from the K2 studios, and we really would encourage you to give us a call at 463-6455, and we will put you on the air. And I think we have a call coming in now. You're on the air.
Hi. I just have a question about the shooting. With a couple of notable exceptions, I think a person would have to have a problem to shoot someone. But so that makes me kind of question, when you're talking about mental illness in your context this evening, are you talking about the full spectrum, which would include like the mentally ill, chronically mentally ill, people with social disorders and untreatable but everything from your sociopaths, narcissists, and psychopaths, and that kind of thing. Are you including that when you're talking about what you're talking about? Because I find myself a little bewildered about the Mount Rainier question. Anyway, I'll listen to what you have to say on the air.
Okay. I'll give a response, and I'd like to ask Katie. What we're talking about is the whole range of what our society might call mentally ill. When we're specifically taking a look at the National Alliance on Mental Illness and their services, and in the literature that I've read for NAMI, they don't mention personality disorders. But I'm going to ask our two guests what range you're talking about, because she's talking about, you mentioned narcissism, so that'd be like narcissistic personality disorder. Let me ask Michelle, do people come into family-to-family with all kinds of, family members with all kinds of problems, or what's the range?
Well, we see people mostly who have family members with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, haven't seen anybody with PTSD yet that's been diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the people that I'm familiar with, that when I took the class and when I've taught the class, are parents.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm one of the few individuals that have a parent with a mental illness, mm-hmm. as opposed to having a child with a mental illness.
Uh-huh.
But as far as narcissistic personality disorder, mm-hmm. that hasn't been mentioned. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of it has to do with our understanding of what mental illness is.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. And now, Katie, what would your response be to that question?
NAMI does have a lot of information resources about personality disorders. There's resources listed on their national website. As far as the family to family class goes, to go back to what the caller had asked, I think we're in this discussion tonight talking about all of it, mental illness in general. What the caller had listed were examples of some of those labels that are thrown out there, right?
Yes, yes. And how that term is used, it's mm-hmm. used one way by insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
It's used other ways. The term mental illness mm-hmm. would be used in other ways because when you get your insurance, if your insurance covers counseling, it's covering mental disorders. And I have to give a diagnosis. And that diagnosis could be as simple as adjustment disorder with some depression. Nobody in the lay world would call that a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of insurance, it's under mental disorders. So that word mental illness slides all over the place. And I'd like to ask our caller, does that suffice? Oh, she's off. Okay.
And I heard her mention serious or chronic.
Yeah.
I mean, that term comes up. You'll see that distinguished in NAMI's resources.
Yeah.
Serious mental illness, meaning chronic and can cause disability.
And disability meaning level of functioning.
Yes.
Yeah. Can't work.
Right.
Can't hold down a job. Can't maintain relationships.
Right.
Can't support themselves.
Right.
And one thing I noticed, does NAMI primarily do services for the family members of folks with mental illness, or do you provide any direct services for people with mental illness?
Well, we don't provide any direct services. We have support, education, and advocacy for family members and for consumers. So for both, we're working with both family members and consumers.
Mm-hmm. And so for NAMI, a consumer is a person that's experiencing a mental illness, and that can be anybody who has, you know, depression, schizophrenia.
A person who either is diagnosed or has been diagnosed in the past.
Exactly.
And a consumer is also considered a family member.
Oh, they are? Okay.
And in some of the reading, I've seen that.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Consumer of services.
Right, right.
Yes. Speaking of which, I had a heyday on the NAMI website.
Mm.
And I noticed that there's a section that says that mental health care in America is in a crisis. The United States gets the grade of D compared to other nations in the world. And of course, we would get a grade probably of D for our healthcare system. Compared to other rich countries, you're probably aware, we're the only country in the world that does not have universal healthcare. And I'm not sure, because I haven't studied this as much, about universal mental health care. But I suppose, because I know they have it in Canada, I know they have health care, mental health care services are free, essentially. We have a cabin in the village of Atlin, British Columbia, and there are 300 residents there, and they have a full-time MSW-level clinician.
That's beautiful.
Working in this village of 300. And all services are free.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. And I know that I'm friends with psychologists in Vancouver, BC,
mm-hmm.
and they've just told me that when you need it, you get it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I see on this that of the states in America, none got A's. It looks like two or three got B's, a couple got C's, a couple got D's, and we're among the D's. We got a D in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And then six states got F's in mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So looks like Alaska has a ways to go.
Right.
Yeah.
I was in Chicago at the NAMI National Conference in July, and I went to a little seminar where they talked about the grading of the states, and there were many state affiliates who were not pleased with that report because just, you know, collection of data and who was to report what data at what time. So it's controversial.
Well, you know, that would be the small print. The big print is the USA gets a D, and we know the data on that, which is we have no free mental health coverage except for some random free clinics. We used to in Juneau, you know, we used to have a sliding scale mental health clinic for all people, not just the chronically mentally ill, because JAMI is serving more the chronically mentally ill. Is that correct?
I believe so.
Yeah. And back in the day, in the old days, we had a wonderful mental health clinic that you could go for marriage counseling. You could go if you had your run-of-the-mill problems in life.
Right.
And it was...
It's expensive to get help.
Oh. It's, in fact, people without insurance. Well,
right.
First of all, a lot of insurance policies don't cover.
You can't afford to be depressed.
You can't afford to be depressed. That's absolutely true. It looks like you also are you a representative on the Suicide Prevention Task Force?
NAMI is a partner with the Juneau Suicide Prevention Task Force.
And what is that?
The task force is made up of several different community members and agencies. They started, I think, in like 2007-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working just toward, well, one of the big things that they've done is they've gone into the schools and they've gotten the signs of suicide curriculum, or excuse me, signs of suicide screening in place. So they're screening all freshmen to identify which ones are at risk for suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, doing whatever is necessary, letting parents know or getting them into support groups. We were able to get a position in our office in NAMI Juneau through the task force to provide community-based services. So he's out in the community providing some trainings about intervention and skills to recognize teaching community members how to recognize signs of suicide and then how to respond to that.
And where are these classes held?
These are...
or to whom are they given?
Right. Well, it's open for the public. It's free every Tuesday, the first Tuesday of every month, first Tuesday of every month at United Way from 5:15 to 7. And that's open to anybody, and it's free. And then if there's, you know, small groups of people like agencies or small organizations that want Chris, the worker who does this, to come to them, he can do that as well. So,
okay, so you have a dedicated staff person.
Yeah.
Working on suicide prevention.
Yes.
Okay, you're doing great work in the schools, it sounds like, particularly with the health classes.
Yes.
I think we touched on this, substance abuse, but do you also work with family members where substance abuse is the only issue? Or is it sometimes hard to tell? Because I think that one confounding factor is if a person has a psychological problem, or you want to call it a mental illness, and they are also abusing drugs or alcohol, it's hard to parse out what's what.
Right.
And so they may think that if the person went into recovery from the substance, they'd be okay. What happens with your organization around substance abuse?
Well, we definitely support individuals and families that have substance abuse in their families. Sometimes it is just substance abuse. Sometimes it is co-occurring. Like Michelle mentioned earlier, when there's a substance abuse problem and a mental health problem, it's called dual diagnosis or co-occurring. You know, I get a lot of phone calls at NAMI from individuals looking for support, and oftentimes they're looking either for a 12-step group or a peer support group for say, bipolar or depression. And so I find that, I mean, not surprising, really, since I, from what I've learned, more than half of people who are diagnosed with bipolar have a substance abuse problem. So I think some people are looking to the 12-step groups for support.
And would you say the high incidence of substance abuse among people with a bipolar or perhaps an other diagnosis has to do with just simple self-medication?
I think that's definitely part of it.
They're self-medicating.
Yeah.
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 And you have a peer-to-peer program, did you say?
We have a peer support group for bipolar and depression. We've partnered with SAIL, Southeast Alaska Independent Living, and these peer support groups are every Wednesday night. Again, no registration, no cost, just show up.
So these support groups are for people diagnosed with bipolar or depression.
Yes.
And I'm curious, why SAIL? What does SAIL, how do they come in?
It was kind of a natural fit for us to partner together. They advocate for folks with disabilities, and mental illness can be a disability. So empowering individuals to be their own best advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Fits right into NAMI's mission as well. So it made sense that we would partner together to provide something like this to the community.
Hey, folks, you've got just under 10 minutes to call in, and this is your chance. If you would give us a call, if you wish, at 463-6455. 463-6455. We'll get you right on the air and hopefully be able to help out with a response from either Katie Chapman, Michelle Thompson, or myself. You work with clients with substance abuse issues, and you say some people call because they may be more interested in a group like Al-Anon.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find there's And Michelle, this is, your family to family. You're doing the education group, but mm-hmm. Katie would be doing the support group. Would there be sometimes a blur between whether somebody should go to Al-Anon or the NAMI support group for family members?
I'm not totally familiar with Al-Anon. I mean, I know what it is, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's, would be a person's preference. Just having that peer support, I think, is what people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Finding people who can relate to them and to their experiences and sharing that experience. In terms of a family member, I think I have often heard of family members going to Al-Anon. But for consumers, I know that it's really quite nice. Looking at the Capital City Weekly, for example, you can see the huge list of all the support groups.
It's wonderful.
And it's so nice. And people say that Juno doesn't have very many resources. I disagree.
And we've got a caller on the air. Okay, you're on the air. Hello?
Oh, gee, I wish you would add a screen caller.
Yes.
Anyway, do you have any stats on the numbers of homeless people in Juneau that have mental health problems or issues?
That's a great question. Very good question, because I think of the Glory Hole and the Salvation Army housing and just the people we see a lot on the streets. So I don't have the statistics. Let me ask Katie if she knows.
I also do not have the statistics. It is a very good question.
And your question then is about the statistics. You mean the number of homeless people with mental illness. Is that it?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. None of us know the numbers, but, that brings up the whole issue of how you define mental illness and the level of functioning. So I think that some people might say that anyone who is living on the streets and is endangering their health has either a substance abuse problem mental illness or both. I'm not saying they do, but I think that that might be a way that some folks would define it, that it would be virtually 100% either substance abuse, mental illness, or both. Any other part of your question?
Well, what can the common citizen do to alleviate that kind of problem?
Well, let's think about it. I do know, okay, one is prevention. The other is cure, and the other is to mitigate suffering. So clearly, our
suffering
community is doing the best they can, or doing what they can, to mitigate suffering. We have shelters for the homeless. We have meals for the homeless. I would say part of what would be prevention would be to have universal mental health coverage for everybody and have more equality of income, because poverty is a big factor in homelessness. And
so it's is it a matter, is it, are you saying that a good deal of this kind of dysfunctionality is due to income equality?
I would imagine that there are homeless people who've lost their jobs, and those people actually may not suffer from any substance abuse or mental illness. I think we've been reading about a lot of people who've lost their mm-hmm. homes. What do you think, Katie?
Oh, I agree with you on everything you've said.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
okay.
I think homelessness and poverty definitely go hand in hand. And income distribution, and a society that has the services, a country that has the services that cares for people. I do know there will always be individuals, no matter how many beds there are at a homeless shelter, there will be some individuals who don't want to go. So,
I would agree.
Okay.
Thank you so much
for your call. And I'm just wondering, Michelle or Katie, either one of you, we just have a couple of minutes left on the show. Any last thing you want to mention for our listeners?
Well, I think the one thing that I hope anybody who's listening to this would take away from it is that there is not, you don't need to be ashamed of a mental illness, whether or not you have it yourself or a family member of yours is experiencing it. If you're ashamed of it, you're not going to get help. And if you get help, you're going to be able to deal with it and grow from the experience.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. Katie, anything?
I guess what I'd want people to take away from this is, you know, however you define mental illness, I don't know, but educate yourself, and that's just the starting point. You know, educate yourself about mental illness, and you know, I think it impacts all of us, whether it's our friend, a relative, or a neighbor. So the more that we know about it, the more we can help,
and the more we know about it, the more compassionate we can be.
Absolutely,
because nobody wants to have a mental illness. We all want to be happy. So thank you so much for tuning in tonight to our program. And I will be hosting another program in February, the first Monday in February. And thank you, Katie Chapman and Michelle Thompson, for coming out on this crisp, cold night. And thank you very much, Jeff Brown, for coming out on your day off to help us man the technical part of the show. Okay, good night.